And welcome to The Truth About Fiction. I'm Lynn Michelle.
And I'm Derek Thompson.
And we're going to talk about the whole hard, grinding business of being a writer, of writing and being published.
We're going to shatter some myths, break some hearts, and hopefully bring you something inspiring. But most of all, we will tell it how it is.
Right. Well, we'll skip all the stuff that people don't need to know about my mysterious leak.
And the I want to know about the mysterious leak.
I can hear it. My partner can't hear it. And it ticks. And it's not tinnitus. Because I can localise it to right under the kitchen unit.
Oh.
So I don't know. Anyway, I digress. Emma, tell us about yourself.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me for a start. I am an author based in the UK. I write contemporary romance books and the occasional children's picture book, which I definitely want to do more of. And last year, I started my own YouTube channel, which I am currently growing and hoping to have monetized very soon.
How does it work in terms of the monetizing? Presumably you need to get so many viewers or followers or...
Yeah. So what you need is 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 hours of watch time. You need to build that up. Or instead of the watch time, you can do it with shorts, but you need, it's crazy, it's like 10 million views over the space of a month or something, or maybe 90 days.
Typically, how long are your YouTube casts?
What I do videos twice a week, and they are typically only between, I guess the longest one is about 25 minutes. The shortest one is just about 6 or 7 minutes. So what I was finding is that I was getting subscribers and I was getting watches, but there just wasn't enough watch time. So during last November, while I was doing NaNoWriMo, I started doing live writing streams. I'm currently doing them 4 days a week and for 3 hours at a time. So that's what really builds up the watch hours, because even if I only have 3 people who stick with me for the 3 hours, I'm getting 9 hours from that, as opposed to potentially much less with the videos.
So is that a case of you just sitting and writing?
Yeah, so basically what I do is we use the Pomodoro method usually. So 25-minute writing sprints. So I put up a timer and write. And then I turn on the microphone and we have a little bit of a chat for a few minutes, see how everybody's doing. And then we go into another sprint. So it's amazing for accountability. It really is, because I've got people that come pretty much to every sprint and they know what I'm working on. So if I turn up and I haven't done anything, like that just, it looks really rubbish. And I swear that that's the only reason why I managed to win NaNoWriMo last year. It was my first time doing it. And I wrote, I think it was 56,000 words in the 30 days. And that book has been signed with our publishers now and is going to be out next year. And I've never written anything that fast before. And generally, like 1,000 words a day is a good writing day for me usually. So that was completely out of my comfort zone. But having to keep my bum in that chair for 3 hours because there were people watching me. And also, I can't fiddle around on the internet too much because of the Wi-Fi connection. So it's not even like I could just sit there and, you know, watch YouTube videos or mess around on Instagram or whatever. I'm kind of having to write. And yeah, that's what did it. During those sessions, I was able to get out 2,000 words at least, maybe 2,500. And it just made it so good. The accountability is brilliant.
How much would you say of that block of writing you retained in the edit?
Pretty much all of it. So what a lot of people do. I mean, have you done NaNoWriMo?
Yes, I used it to kickstart a novel. I can't remember which one. And it was really good for that. My problem, I think, was... I don't know if you plan your books out or you just sort of meander through them when they occur to you.
I plan completely.
Well, this was one I hadn't planned. Some of them I believe I've planned, and then the characters say, no, we're not doing that. We're going over here. We're going in a different one. So it was good in terms of having the volume of word count. But for me, I think it veered so far from the plan that chunks of it, significant chunks, didn't make the grade. But years and years ago, when the world was young, I did some coaching for people. And that accountability, as you say, is key, because if the sort of accountability gene. If people know that someone is going to say to them, so how did you get on with the 1,000 envelopes you were sending out?
Yeah.
There is this, I don't know if it's inbred from us from school, but there's this sense of not wanting to disappoint.
Yeah, and people know.
It's a silly question, but because it's a genre I'm not familiar with as an author, what would you say are the elements of a good contemporary romance?
There are two elements, and that is the, well, there's the, it's the hero and heroine, and it is their internal and external conflict. That is what is important. That's the essence of the story. It sounds very rude, but the best advice for writing a romance is don't go wider, go deeper. You don't add in a load of extra characters, a load of extra subplots. You don't make it any more complicated. It's about going deeper into the relationship, into the conflicts that are keeping them apart, and exploring that in greater detail. And that's what makes a good romance.
I must admit, I read Pride and Prejudice late. Still now, I think it's one of the funniest novels I've ever read.
Oh, yes. It's hilarious. Absolutely
and
hilarious.
Still so applicable to sort of social mores and the way people behave and class. So nothing changes in that regard.
No, absolutely.
Probably what the reason why I ended up writing in the genres that I do is I tend to be drawn towards complexity. And I like repeat characters. So do you find in your novels there are any characters, sort of walk-ons from...
I have done that a couple of times with little kind of appearances by characters from other books. And what I was thinking for Camp NaNoWriMo in July, I was going to attempt to write a Regency romance. Just, I'd love to know if I could. But there's a character from one of my books, Her Perfect Hero, Sebastian Fairfax. And he's son of a lord, and they live at, I think it's Fairfax Hall. I really need to reread the book. I don't know if it's the same with you, but I forget the details of my books, like, after a while. I mean, It's been about 8 years since I wrote that one. Anyway, what I was hoping to do is have Fairfax Hall in the Regency period and have, you know, his ancestors appearing in that book, which I thought could be quite fun.
I think readers like those kind of Easter eggs. I mean, my challenge is, because I tend to write serials, I have to know who got on with who in book three, because sure as eggs is eggs, they won't get on in book five. I was looking at book one of it's sort of my take on spy thrillers. And I realised that one of the characters who was a chauffeur changed his name. It was Trevor in book one. He didn't appear again till book three. And now he's called Philip. And I was thinking, do I mention that?
Like that, aren't they? Yeah. Characters are tricky with changing names and getting confused.
You mentioned Regency. So do you do a lot of research for... So I don't know much about your books. Are they all set in one historical period?
So all of the books that I've done so far are contemporary. So they're set now. So nice and easy. But I do love the Regency period. And I just thought it would be a really interesting... thing to attempt. You know, I thought it would be a fun writing exercise, if nothing else. And giving myself Camp NaNo to do it means that it will be contained. So I won't end up kind of dragging it out over 6 months and trying to fit it in amongst other things, was my thinking. I mean, the thing is that they do need to be a bit longer than I'm used to writing, because my books are typically only about 55 to 60k at the most. Right. Whereas a Regency is more like 70. So I don't know. I don't think I'll be able to get the whole thing done during camp.
But I am
quite precious about my words, because you were saying about when you'd done NaNo and you found that there was a lot that just, you know, you couldn't use in the end because they'd veered off. And I think that does happen to a lot of people, because they go into camp and the idea is to write as much as possible.
Yes.
But what I was actually doing was, at the beginning of each writing session, I was reading through what I'd written the day before and going over it. So I was actually, and people say don't edit as you go along. I was editing as I went along, because that's what worked for me. So I knew exactly where I was. And I was also very aware that if I write too fast, like you say, the characters veer off.
Yes.
And I needed them to stick, because, you know, with a romance, you have to have the hero and heroine, or the heroine and heroine, whatever. You have to have them get together at the end. So that had to happen. So I couldn't have them veering off and meeting somebody else or doing something that I hadn't planned. So I was very conscious of bringing them back in line if they started to to Veer and making sure that I did that. So that meant that there weren't really any wasted words. I think I used everything. Pretty much. I mean, you know, like obviously, you know, there'll be some just, smile and look and all of our crutch words that end up
just
in there.
Just is my particular crutch word. Just, yeah.
Well.
And that, for some reason.
Okay. My characters say okay like all the time. It drives me mad. It's like,
I think my biggest challenge sometimes is how much swearing to put in, because the characters swear a lot and I think I'm not so sure. And some of the, I don't know if you find that, there's a definite split between UK readers and US readers.
The US ones don't like the swearing, do they?
It's very interesting. Some of the feedback I had, if they don't know a word, I mean, we put a glossary in.
Yeah.
So, well, we'll put a glossary in, which, of course, has got ever longer, because now it's a bit of a challenge for me to, let's see what slang word would be appropriate from different languages. Because obviously, mine's set in London, which is very sort of multicultural and has always been. Mm-hmm. And the food, so I like to sort of play with that. But also I think if there are places they don't know, that they tend to tune out. Whereas for me, if I read a book and there's a word I don't know, or there's food, or there's a place, for me that's more interesting, because you get drawn into that world.
Yeah, and also you just look it up, don't you? You know, if there's,
well,
something,
especially now. Yeah, exactly, you just click a button.
Like, I think most people who love reading, if they've always, if you come up with something that you don't know, you look it up. You know, before the internet, you just used a dictionary, didn't you?
In the good old days, yes, real books.
Yeah,
now, Kindle, other, as I always say, other taxpaying platforms are available. You can actually highlight the word and get an explanation.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have found a definite sort of split in that UK audiences generally are more receptive to the characters, but that could be because they're reading about Brits, and Australians seem to like it as well. Mm. Interestingly,
yeah, I think it depends on the characters. If it is reasonable that those characters would swear, then it needs to have the swearing in it, because that is how they would speak. My characters, my books don't have swearing, because I know that that's not what my readers want, and it's probably not how my characters would generally speak. Therefore, also my mother-in-law reads them and she wouldn't like
them. I was once in a writers group. I've been in a few, but then again too few to mention. And one of them worked really well. We were all sort of budding novelists. And the idea was that everybody bought a chapter and somebody else would read it. Mm-hmm. And I passed it on to a woman, long-term friend of mine, who said, OK, I'll start now. And it was only she got partway in, I realised it was quite an explicit section. I thought, yeah, it was, and funny enough, it was, when I wrote the scene, it had sort of been suggested, I wouldn't say by the character per se. They do sometimes. I mean, sometimes I hear a little voice that says, let's do this. But this was more to give an illustration of how bad the character was, mm-hmm. as it were. And so I wrote it feeling pretty uncomfortable and completely forgotten about it. That's the gift of trauma. Mm-hmm. And then this person read it out. And there was this kind of, there were only five of us in the group. There was a sort of stunned silence. Someone said, that's a really good piece of writing. You know, you really pushed the envelope. And I've never pushed it that far since. So if the books have gone on with the same characters, mm-hmm. there's much more implied. There are fewer sort of sex scenes. I suppose the challenge for your books as well is how you represent the different characters, and also, I suppose, how you represent the difference between male and female experience of relationships.
I think most of my book's perspective is told through the female perspective, if you like, both just because that's what I tend to write naturally in, but also because that keeps a little, and most of my readers are female, but also that kind of keeps a little bit of mystery going sometimes in the storyline, because if you're, you know, if you're not quite sure how, you know, what the man is feeling, why he's doing these things, maybe if he's behaved a little bit strangely, and then you can reveal that as the story goes along, rather than him just going, oh, I'm being weird, because that does seem to work quite well. But I do have scenes from the male perspective as well, but yeah, definitely not as many. It does tend to be the female perspective that I'm writing from.
How did the children's writing come about? Was that something you always had in background, sort of in parallel, or
so that's actually what I started with when my eldest was a baby, and he's going to be 20 this year, which is so stupid. I can't even describe how stupid that is. But I loved reading to all of my children when they were little, and I had some ideas for some stories. And I started writing them down and I really enjoyed doing it. And I sent off to some children's publishers back in the days when we printed it out and we put it in a stamped addressed envelope, wasn't it, inside, so they could send it back to you and everything, without realizing quite how incredibly difficult it is to get children's picture books published, because, you know, it's not easier, it's the wrong word. It's quicker, there we go, that's a better word, to write a picture book than it is to write a full-length novel. So if a publishing house, well, most of them don't accept unsolicited manuscripts anyway for picture books, but if they already have several writers, well, those writers can write many picture books, many more than, you know, you or I could write a full-length novel. So they just don't need to take on as many writers. And also, because I don't illustrate, I'm completely rubbish at art. I don't illustrate. So I kind of put that then on the back burner when I started writing my first romance, The Green Hills of Home, which was almost a little bit of a dare with myself, because I'd read an article. I read all kinds of books, maybe not very much kind of sci-fi or horror necessarily, but I do try to read quite widely. So it's by no means just romance that I actually read, but I do enjoy reading romance. And I also find that when I'm reading other genres, it's the romantic element, if there is one, that I'm particularly invested in. Anyway, I'd read an article somewhere that was basically this woman saying that it was really easy to write a romance book because they're all completely formulaic and anybody could do it in just a few weeks.
Wow.
And I was like, that's stupid. Like, no, I mean, I've never attempted to write one before, but that can't be the case. So I was like, okay, I'll write a romance book and see if I can do it. And so, yeah, that's how that came about, the kind of change between the genres. And then I've got one picture book out at the moment, which I self-published. My friend illustrated it and it's completely beautiful. And then I have others already. It is called The Snotty Princess.
Okay.
I have a copy of it here, but there's not much point in showing you because there's not going to be visual. So,
no, if you send me a link for where it's available, when these are posted on the site, which used to be called Anchor and I think is now Spotify because everything changes, we'll put the link
awesome.
If they still give me a box postings, and I can put it on LinkedIn, which is where I seem to live most of the time. Yeah. So are you going to do other books with the same illustrator? Is that your intention?
I'm hoping to. She hasn't been able to for the last few years, so she hasn't been able to, but I have got others ready for her if she would like to do it. It's an awful lot of work though, doing a picture book, because it's just so visual. So it was actually my husband who did the technical side of things, and he was incredibly patient because we wanted things like each of the main characters has got their own special font that kind of shows some of their character. So Princess Sophie, because she's a princess, she has rainbow hair because princesses should have rainbow hair. And so her writing is also multicolored. Her mother is very fancy, so her font is very fancy and things. So I think, we drove my husband absolutely crazy with all of these mad things that we wanted to add into it. So I think we might have to keep it a little simpler for the next one.
Are they going to be available as ebooks as well?
Yeah, so the Snotty Princess is available on Amazon, and it's a paperback and an ebook, and it's available on Kindle Unlimited, which is something that I did during the thing that we don't mention that happened a couple of years ago, but I probably shouldn't say it in case it flags something up. Period of time, I popped it on Kindle Unlimited because I know that there were a lot of parents at home with their kids trying, you know, to find things for their kids to do when they weren't at school. And I just thought, you know, there's not much that I can do to help, but I can put that on. And then if they have Kindle Unlimited, they can read this story to their kids for free. And that might be a nice.
Which says a lot. I did write a children's book, which was published for about 3 months, I think. I can't remember. It was a US publisher ebook, and they eventually went bust. I tried to use the book because it's a book about bullying, but it's a fiction. It's a sort
of. Presumably, they didn't go bust because of your book.
Well, who can say? I mean, a previous publisher before a contract was signed had a heart attack and died, so it is possible.
Oh.
Yes, that was unfortunate. Yeah. I've mentioned that in previous podcasts. Yeah, it was a bit of a strange one. It was the first book I'd written, which I published to Ingemini, and the contract was sent over. I joined the Society of Authors, and there were all sorts of changes they suggested, just small changes. I sent it back, and it was radio silence for a period of about 3 weeks, and I was getting a bit anxious. And I contacted them again, and they said, we're very sorry to tell you that your editor has died.
No.
And they assigned a new editor who hated the book. It might not have been a very good book at that point. And it eventually, because it had been everywhere, I self-published it. But that aside, children's book, which might actually be on Kindle now. I don't know. I can't remember what I've done with it. My biggest challenge was getting some sense of the age group. I mean, I think it's listed as mid-grade, which is, I suppose, sort of 8 to 12-esque.
Yeah.
But I wonder with picture books what the age range is typically.
I mean, obviously, you read picture books, you know, to babies. I certainly did with all of mine. But I would say that they get the most out of this Naughty Princess from about age 3 to 6.
Okay.
So, I mean, I must have read thousands of picture books over the years, many of them over and over and over again. So I was very aware of the type of language to use, and something that's really fun to do with that age group, because the books are generally being read to them, is to throw in some longer words that sound really nice, that are just a little bit different, that they don't hear in everyday conversation. And it helps them to learn new words, because the meaning of it is usually clear from the context, but obviously whoever's reading it to them could explain it as well. But I really love doing that. That's something that Roald Dahl definitely did an awful lot, and it's really fun just to throw in a really interesting word in the middle of this fairly simple language.
How many pages typically is a picture book?
So they're usually 32 pages long, but, you know, it varies. The length is generally about 1,000 words, roughly. So obviously, you know, with a picture book, because you've got all the illustrations, sometimes you'll have pages that don't have any writing on at all. They'll just be an illustration. Sometimes some of them you've got writing on all the pages, a small amount of writing. We've got a mixture. That was the other thing we really wanted to do with this Naughty Princess, was just make it really visually interesting.
Nice.
So the writing's in different places on all pages. It's on a slant sometimes. It goes down the stairs in one point as the princess is coming down the stairs as well. You know, it moves here, there and everywhere. If there's, you know, if there's a word like pop, for example, it will be big like a pop. And it's really making it visually interesting for the child to look at. So again, my poor husband. It was ridiculous. We were complete pains. We really were.
So if he wasn't a graphic designer before, he was by the end.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was educational in every sense.
Yeah.
So would you describe, as you know, we didn't plan this at all, so I never quite know what's coming up in the back of my head. So that's always true. Would you say you're sort of more of an introvert or an extrovert in terms of not only sort of presenting your work to readers, but also engaging with an audience?
I am an introvert. I do my best to kind of put myself forward to readers and things, but I think there's always part of you, as somebody like me, who is holding back a little bit from pushing too much with the sales pitch and showing off, you know, what you've got. So I've been doing a social media for writers series on my YouTube channel. And the months that I've been doing it, I take a different social media platform each month, and I kind of give my accounts a makeover and talk through what I've learned, share some tips and tricks. And I'm doing Instagram this month. So for a video, I was showing my Instagram account and scrolling down and saying, like, okay, so I know that I shouldn't be doing this. This could be better. You know, this is good. And what I noticed is that I hadn't actually posted a picture of one of my book covers or anything about my books for 4 months.
Wow. How many platforms do you actually use?
So obviously I'm on YouTube,
yep.
Facebook. I have a page and a profile. Twitter.
I should add that the YouTube vids are very good, because I watched them.
Thank you.
I mean, that was what inspired me to have this conversation, because I think what's good about you on YouTube is you come across as very natural. You're just yourself, like you are here, you know.
I'm the most human of humans. It's what I say when one of my streams goes completely wrong again because I've forgotten to turn the microphone back on and I've been talking to myself for the last couple of minutes. Most human. But yeah, and so I'm on, what did I say? So Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, although I don't do that properly because I don't like TikTok. I'm too old.
I've heard lots of things about how TikTok is the way to sell books. And
TikTok is the, yeah, but I think it's still the case that all the authors who have done amazingly through TikTok sales, like Colleen Hoover, it's because of the readers.
Yeah.
It's the readers on BookTok sharing about the book. It's not the authors or the publishers, you know. So, I mean, I'm sure that you can make book sales on TikTok as an author. But I, as far as I'm aware, it's still not the case that any author has gone completely viral with their books because of their TikTok account. It's the readers doing it for them.
We're in a, I suppose you could say, strange but fortunate position in the promo for Joffrey Books, but I don't see why it shouldn't be. I mean, they're very good at marketing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
as we know, they've made a point of saying, if there's anything you think that's worth trying, we've probably done it. Or we're going to do it. And it is lovely to be able to kind of sit back and let them get on with that, subject to getting the sales. So have you attended any writing conferences, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I've been to the Romantic Novelists Association conference a couple of times, which is just absolutely brilliant. It's so inspiring. You come back just buzzing with all the different ideas that you've got and all the things that you've heard and that you want to implement and you want to do. It's definitely something. I mean, I don't know if you've attended any, but it's definitely something that I think writers should do if they possibly can.
I think the difficulty for me, because I live in the far west, not that far from Land's End, I suppose, so getting to anywhere, I think there's a Crime Fest in Bristol.
Yes.
That's trip to the Himalayas at the moment. I like the idea of it. I think the difficulty for me in attending these is, do you ever have this idea of, even though there shouldn't be, there is always some kind of sort of league table. I mean, partly there's a league table in our heads.
Yeah.
But I think the difficulty for me is I can't quite figure out who my peers are. So as a consequence, going to a conference, I'd never be sure whether I should be going to the how-tos or trying to hear the sort of the big hitters speak, some of whom obviously we know from our publishing. I think I have something of an identity crisis in terms of where I'm at as an author. I mean, some of it is internal. If you feel, for example, that you're doing all the things that you want to do, you're writing the books that you want to do, and you're sort of fulfilling your potential, for want of a better term, then there's a certain stability or security that comes from that. That's not to say there aren't more books to be written. I think for me, because I'm currently sort of writing in two different but allied genres, I'm never quite sure who I am. And I have other books in other genres that I'm currently learning script writing for a different book that's unpublished to try and adapt that. So it's interesting what you were saying about your characters and your books, about it's depth that matters. I think as writers, if you can find, if you're wired that way, you find a genre that sort of absorbs you sufficiently and you can sort of embed yourself. I think for me, the challenge is I'm a bit torn in different directions.
Yeah, but that can work really, really well because, you know, the skills that you put into play for one type of writing, you can tweak and use in a different genre, and which will really give it a different take and make it different from other people's. Maybe
I think there's a challenge in specifically writing cross-genre novels because some expectations are exceeded but some were thwarted. But what I found was some people who loved fantasy, other readers were disappointed for other reasons, some of which they felt inclined to put on a review, which is fine. That's fine. Listen, that's the game we're in.
Oh, yeah, completely. I don't even look at reviews anymore. It's not worth it, is it?
Well, I don't know. I think if it were constructive criticism, it's a bit after the fact, isn't it?
Yeah.
The book is out there.
Yeah.
But sometimes I've found some of the reviews, probably the more positive ones, they're useful for giving you some taglines if ever you do your own promotional work for the books. And some of them, I find it interesting. There were two, maybe three reviews I remember, broadly remember, that would stand out for me. One was a person just talked about one of the spy novels and they clearly got what I was doing. what it was supposed to be. They said, you know, this character is not James Bond. He's the sort of antithesis of James Bond. He's working class. And as one of the characters told me, and I wrote this down, he's working at the arse end of British intelligence, which was a quote from one of the other characters. So this person in their commentary clearly got it. Someone else called it a comic book Le Carre, and then sort of almost justify that by saying, you know, for all I know, that's how it actually is. And that's gratifying. A lot of it is just people saying it was nice or it was too long. But I'm intrigued that you don't read the review.
When my book, His Secret Daughter, came out, that's now, it's got a new name change. It's the one that got away now. There were a couple of reviews that were like one star reviews for it because they were saying that the Spanish that I used in it wasn't correct and that I should have checked the Spanish. So it wasn't Spanish. The guy's speaking Catalan. I make it completely clear that he's not speaking Spanish. He speaks Spanish sometimes. The bits that they're talking about are when he's gone home to his mother and they are speaking Catalan. It is correct Catalan. You're right. It's not correct Spanish because I never said he was speaking Spanish. And it was at that moment, it was like, oh, it's like, it's not worth it. I so wanted to reply, but obviously I didn't because you should never reply to the reviews. But it was just so frustrating. I did have, when that book was re-released at the end of last year with the name change, Amazon messed up with swapping the reviews over. So it was really strange. They swapped some of the reviews, but not others. And it was a good couple of months that I was going back and forth and they were saying, oh, the reviews there. And I was saying, no, there's like 600 reviews or something missing. Yeah. Like, I need these back. And at that point, I was checking those reviews to check that they were, that they were coming in. And eventually, after a lot of harassment on my part to various members of the KDP customer service community, I did get all of those reviews back, which was brilliant. But because I was keeping an eye on it, I did see a few of them. And one of the most recent ones was that somebody said that they really loved the story, but they were disappointed because they hadn't seen Iris and Sergio, the hero and heroine, get married. And they were disappointed that there hadn't been a wedding. Oh. So that is now something I'm writing at the moment. I'm doing a sequel novella.
Right.
I'm not quite sure when that's going to be done at the moment because I've had to put that on the back burner. But yeah, so that was something that did come out of looking at those reviews. So that was a good thing. But generally, I don't.
Well, I think, as I say, I think you probably save a lot of time. I mean, in the end, these things, like the rankings, they're out of our control. They're out of everybody's control.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if people really don't like it, then it's fair enough that they're saying that's what reviews are there for, and there's nothing that you can do to change it. I mean, I guess it might influence the book that, you know, the next book that you're writing, if there were a lot of reviews, a lot of bad reviews.
Possibly.
I mean, I suppose, like, I would notice if there were loads of bad reviews, if my, you know, if my latest book came out and it was, you know, it had like a 2-star ranking on Amazon, then I would go in and I'd have a look and I'd be like, what?
I did get a 1-star review once because somebody couldn't download it to Kindle, which I thought was hilarious. I mean, where do you go with that? You just say, okay. Fair enough.
Well, there was one that I read about where somebody got a 1-star review for their book because the reviewer wrote that it arrived smelling a bit of eggs. And he's like, what do you That's do with brilliant. That? Like,
I mean, that could actually be a sales gimmick, couldn't it? If it was about the for authenticity.
Order this book now while it still smells of eggs. Get the special limited edition bacon smell.
Can't make a relationship without breaking eggs, and this book is proof of that. So you mentioned, obviously, that you write contemporary romances. So when you say contemporary, do you mean what is now, unbelievably, 21st century?
Yes,
so
as it is now. I mean, obviously, my first book is now, I believe it's 10 years old this year. So, you know, we didn't have WhatsApp, for example.
Yeah.
When I was writing that. But I did have my editor at the time going through the manuscript said that he didn't think that some of the story was realistic because I can't remember the details, but basically there wouldn't be anybody who didn't have like a Wi-Fi signal for their phone, I think it was, in particular.
No.
And there were various other bits because it's set in rural Wales. So I went back and I said, I'm sorry, you're living in London. But no, this is correct. Like my friend is a farmer's wife and their water comes completely from the well in the garden. You know, there's no way that they could have broadband. You know, where I was living at the time, we didn't have broadband or anything like that. There was no, we couldn't even have a home phone because the BT couldn't get a line up to the house. If we wanted to make a phone call, we had to walk up the lane and try to find a little bit of a signal. There was a tree, and if you stood at the right angle underneath this tree, you could make a phone call. And that's what we had to do for the first 3 months that we lived there before we managed to get like a little Wi-Fi unit. You know, this isn't London, this isn't Manchester.
But there
are places that are still like that.
Certainly Granite is no friend to mobile or Wi-Fi. You mentioned about living rurally. So are all your contemporary romances urban, rural, or a mixture?
They're a mixture, and there tends to be more rural. My latest release, which was out in January, is Falling in Love at Nightingale Farm. And that was lots of fun to write because that's a city girl who has to go and help save a farm which is in dire straits and needs her business help to sort it out. That was just so much fun to write because you had the beautiful rural setting, but you also had this city girl in her high heels, you know, stepping in cowpats and not able to get a phone signal and everything. So I think my readers do tend to really like rural settings. I've heard a lot of positive things, particularly about my first book that was set in Wales and how much they like that setting. So I do tend to stick to that. Although having said that, my best selling book was set, I suppose some of it's rural, but most of it was set in London or Barcelona. So, you know.
In terms of sort of research for romance, what kind of things do you end up, apart from Catalan, clearly? What kind of elements do you find that you need to research to sort of ground it in authenticity?
So, I mean, obviously, it depends where it's being set. Like with Falling in Love at Nightingale Farm, I have a lot of friends because of living in rural Wales. I've got a lot of friends who are farmers' wives who've helped out on farms and things. So there's one particular scene where there's some lambs being born and the ewe is having difficulty. So I sent that to a friend of mine and said, could you just let me know if this is realistic? And she just sent back like a laughing emoji and was like, I'll help you. Like, don't worry. This is because I spent the first 23 years of my life was in London. I've never seen a lamb being born in my life. Basically, yeah, she said it was too citified. It was too nice. It wasn't gruesome enough. For my book Centre Stage, I don't know whether it's going to keep that title actually, but that's been signed to come out next year. That was great fun to research because my heroine's a ballerina. So that was lots of fun as a little girl who was never allowed to do ballet because I'm like a fairy elephant, apparently. It was great fun to research the life of a ballerina and read some biographies and watch films and stuff about what the ballet world is actually like. But my biggest issue with that book, though, is because I do write a lot about food because I love food. I just really love eating, and food features a lot in my books. But I thought, OK, so she's a ballerina. And obviously they have to be extremely healthy and they also have to be extremely slim. But I didn't want to venture into any kind of potential eating disorder or anything like that, because that's not what my books are about. They're light, they're fun, they're supposed to be happy. I didn't want to go down that road at all. So it was trying to be very conscious that she does need to eat healthily, but make sure that she is seen to eat as well. Whereas, I mean, I'm sure that there's a massive problem in the ballet industry as a whole with the dancers with eating disorders. But I suppose,
as you say, it's important to know your audience. As you say, you know, your books are happy because that's what people want. I mean,
that's what they expect from an Emma Bennett book.
Although we write because it's in us or it's an art or a craft, some of it is right, especially now we're published, writing to be read. One of the
definitely the
nicest reviews I got from somebody, it just said that it was a good airport read. And I was so pleased with that because I thought it's not Shakespeare. You pick it up
and you can't put it down, and it gets you through having to wait around the airports. That's brilliant. But I think that's what a lot of writers who are just starting out don't understand is that Yes. So thankfully, you know, there's an amazing self-publishing industry now and community, and there's so much you can do and go down that route if you'd like to. But if you want to land a publisher and if you want to be selling a lot of books, you've got to write what people want and what people expect. You know, you can't go completely nuts and take an element from this, an element from this, an element from this, an element from this, and expect HarperCollins to sign you. They're just not going to. It might be that you can self-publish and you can find an audience and you end up doing absolutely fantastically, but definitely not if you want to go the traditional route.
So what, you mentioned the RNA conference. Have you already been there this year, or is that
sort of... No, I'm not going this year. I went last year, and then I went, I think it was 2018 or 2019. Can't remember, but I'm not able to go this year, but maybe next year.
There seems to be a lot of crime fest that seems to be
big. Yes, I'm trying to think, because there's one that's at Harrow. I'm not sure. There's Harrogate. One that I've heard about that's at Harrow.
I think it's Harrogate is a big crime fest. There's one in Bute in Scotland.
Right, yeah. Well, that really would be far for you to get to, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just a tad. I think there's one in Newcastle. There's bound to be one in London. There's certainly a lot of crime in London, as I remember.
Yeah.
But that's...
May as well make a festival of it. Why not?
I think organised crime groups do, in fact, but that's by the by. Well, look, I shall wrap this up so that you can go about your day, but thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure to finally talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I can't believe how long it took to set this up.
And especially bearing in mind that indirectly you're one of the people responsible for me signing with our publisher, because you were the first person I contacted. Seem to have lost comms. So I think on that note, thank you, Emma. Oh, you're back.
I didn't realise I'd gone anywhere. I was here the whole time.
I was just saying, I'll say it again because it will probably look weird on the recording. But indirectly, you're one of the people responsible for me signing with our publisher, because you were the first person I communicated with all those years ago.
Yeah, about, what was it, like 9 years ago, maybe?
It was 2015. Yeah.
Right.
Before the thing that shall not be mentioned.
Yeah, that we don't mention because we don't want anything to get flagged up.
No, quite. Okay, well, listen, thank you for your time, and see you online.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.